Welcome to the Misophonia Podcast. This is Season 7, Episode 22. My name is Adil Ahmad, and I have misophonia. This week I'm talking to Ciara, host of my favorite psychology podcast, the Behind the Stigma Podcast, and I'm not just saying that because I was on it once. Ciara is based in Dubai and often in London, with a background in psychology and neuroscience from King's College London. We talk all about growing up in Azerbaijan, her family dynamics and reaction to misophonia. We talk about different therapies and neurostimulation studies, visual triggers, boundary issues, HSP and other constructs, dysregulation, and a lot more. And we also talk about the idea of conscious dancing at the end, which is a big passion of hers and helps her a lot. After the show, of course, let me know what you think. You can reach me by email at hello@misophoniapodcast.com or hit me up on Instagram or Facebook at Misophonia Podcast. By the way, please do head over and leave a quick rating wherever you listen to the show, on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It helps move us up in the algorithms when folks are learning when folks are searching misophonia. A few of my usual announcements. Thanks again for the incredible ongoing support on Patreon. If you feel like contributing, you can read all about the various levels at patreon.com/misophoniapodcast. And of course, I want to plug the book Sounds Like Misophonia by Dr. Jane Gregory and I. It's a self-help book on misophonia. You can get it anywhere in the world, online, offline. It's published from Bloomsbury Publishers, and you can find links to order in the show notes. This episode is also sponsored by the personal journaling app Basil, B-A-S-A-L, that I developed. Basil provides AI-powered insights into your journal entries and guides you daily with new writing prompts based on those insights. You can even explore many different therapy approaches, modalities, and philosophies. It's available on iOS or Android. Check the show notes or go to hellobasil.com. All right, here's my conversation with Ciara. Ciara, welcome to the podcast. Great to have you here.
Hey, Adil. Thank you so much. I'm very excited to be here. A little nervous, but very excited.
Yeah, no worries. No worries. It's great conversation. Do you want to tell us just a little bit about kind of where you are?
Yeah, for sure. Firstly, right off the bat, it's so funny because just before we got on the podcast, the first thing I thought is like, shit, I better not breathe too loud because I'm going to piss off all the listeners on here. So it's at the same time, it's great that, you know, you can say this out loud. You can think this out loud and think, lol, people would actually understand what I mean, you know, because if you say that to anyone else, they'll be like, what? But yep. Yeah, so that's always a good thing. But at the same time, you're like, oh, shit, I better not make any extra noise not to trigger or piss anyone off. But yeah, so I'm actually based in Dubai, UAE, United Arab Emirates. I grew up here, but I'm originally from Azerbaijan. But yeah, I guess I call both my home.
Oh, okay, cool. Yeah, I never asked you. I was curious kind of what your background was. So yeah, I haven't talked to somebody from Dubai or Azerbaijan. So
there you go. It's a double win.
Yeah. And yeah, but the breathing, don't worry about it. I mean, you know, I put like brown noise in the background and it's kind of the ointment for many ills. Like it kind of gives everybody like a, you know, some white noise in the background, and then it covers up like, you know, any kind of potential, well, not any kind of potential, but a lot of potential, yeah, like trigger sounds and whatnot. So yeah, don't worry about it. Well, that's really cool. So do you want to talk a bit, like, so how did you, I guess, how did you get to Dubai from kind of, what was your life, yeah, kind of path?
Sure. That's kind of crazy. So we moved here in like back in 92. So great. Now everyone knows my age, but we moved here when I was like literally 2 years old. Mm-hmm. And my dad just started a business here. So think of Dubai when it was still a desert, right? Like now when you see Dubai, it's all skyscrapers, right? Like it's pretty amazing here. But back then it was still pretty underdeveloped. It was, mm-hmm, small buildings, you know, not more than like one mall. So it's actually surreal to see how it's shifted in the past 20 plus years. And yeah, I used to travel to like Azerbaijan during the summer, but most of my life I've just spent it here. So Dubai is honestly my home. And, mm-hmm, even when I travel, as much as this sucks, I'm always like, I get like the itch to go home, you know, I'm like, oh, I miss the heat. And I, especially when I travel the winter. So yeah, that's kind of my story, honestly. Travel around a lot, but I've always been based here in Dubai.
Okay. And I know that you're, so let's, we'll talk about maybe you're, because you go to London a lot, and I'm assuming it sounds like you're, I mean, your school in London. And the listeners know a little bit about your podcast. Obviously, I've been on it and I mentioned it in the preamble. But so it sounds like you're spending a lot of time in London. Do you want to talk about, I guess, kind of what you're studying and your kind of the background of your interest in psychology?
Yeah, sure. So funnily enough, I'm actually traveling to London after tomorrow again. So there you go. But yeah, so my background's in, now it is in psychology and neuroscience of mental health. So I did my master's at King's College London. But during my master's, I came across this organization in the UK called Student Minds. And it's basically like a charity that focuses on student mental health in the UK along, you know, with other things. And it's more about collaborative research. So it basically intersects universities and students and allows the student voice to be kind of at the forefront. So I've been working with them for 2 years, and we do, well, this week is going to be like our first in-person meeting, but most of the meetings are online. But I do travel back and forth to the UK just because my university was there, my master's was there. And then B, it just kind of turned out because doing my master's there, as I was connected with so many other students within my field. So we do a lot of like meetups and hangouts and things like that as well, you know, so it's both like from a university perspective and, you know, studies and things like that. But then kind of it became a place where I would just like comfortably like go back and forth to. And yeah, so recently, I mean, soon I'm looking to do my PhD as well. And I'll be checking out a few schools again in the UK. So yeah. Feel like that's kind of like become my new place now that you've mentioned it.
Cool. Yeah. No, I didn't know you had done your master's and you were still kind of going back there. And kind of, do you know when you plan to start your PhD? Is that next year?
Well, fingers crossed. Yeah. Fall 2024. So September 2024, it's given me a bit of a while to prep mentally and, you know, all that stuff. But no.
What do you, do you have any idea what direction do you want to take it? Obviously, you're with your podcast, you're exposed to a lot of different things. I'm just curious if there's anything that you know, sticks out to you.
Yeah. So the field that I'll be going into, so the PhD will be in the field of philosophy of psychiatry. So it's a particular field that focuses on questions that surround psychiatry, in particular, in my interest, it would be mental disorders. So it thinks about things like the ethics of mental disorders, you know, morality, questions like what does it mean to have a delusion, you know, and how is a delusion any different from, for example, someone who may have an irrational form of a belief, you know? And so it comes from it from a more philosophical approach. But my PhD will actually focus on student perceptions on mental disorders. So how students in particular in the UK population view mental disorder classifications, and in turn, how does that reflect on how they seek help or do not seek help? So, and of course, the impact could be, you know, very different depending on multiple factors. So that's kind of what I want to explore, because the field is very divided right now. You know, there's the holistic approach.
Yeah.
You know, there's those that are completely against classifications. There are those that find it liberating and stigmatizing. So that's kind of the gist of it. Are the perceptions of mental disorders liberating or stigmatizing to people? And if so, why? And kind of the role of biological explanations. There's clearly a lot I want to explore in that study.
Yeah,
but
no, this is all fascinating stuff. As a layperson who's, you know, who's got a bit of a brain, I can kind of see, you can kind of sense that.
You definitely do.
That kind of conflict in that. Well, not, I don't want to say conflict, but that kind of like all these debates in the field, and I find it fascinating on a philosophical level. But I think what you're alluding to also kind of on a practical policy level or person level, because it affects how, if and how people seek help and what help they'll get. Because sometimes you'll go, you know, you'll just go to somebody and it could be there's like three different, completely different directions, and you'll be, you know, shuttled into one because of insurance or something like that, and they might not be the help you need.
Exactly. No, that's exactly how it is, right? Based on the way things are currently done, it's as in the impact on people are based on the current, you know, regulations or the clinical procedure. So actually looking into these questions, the hope is that, okay, are we actually giving the right support to people? Is this exactly particular for me? Again, I'm focusing within like student population. So maybe that would be more in terms of university resources and things like that.
All right.
But no, you're absolutely right from that perspective.
Well, we could go on for hours just on this topic, but maybe we can steer it a little bit back to misophonia. I guess, do you want to maybe rewind back again to kind of like when you first started to, I guess, notice misophonia?
Yeah, much like most of, you know, the people who come on your podcast, it started when I was very, very young. I think when I was 8 or 9, mm-hmm. and my grandfather, bless his soul, feels so horrible, but he was the first person that created a sort of reaction within me. He would eat mm-hmm. in a very unpleasant way, which, you know, weren't very pleasant to my ears. So my poor grandfather, I would like shun him and be like, "Grandpa, you can't sit with me while we're eating." And he's like, "Wait, what?" So, mm-hmm. Yeah, it was very disturbing, I would say, for me. Some of my uncles as well would make, you know, like the slurping of soup. So it definitely started with food. That's what I've noticed. The trigger sounds, I know some people don't like to use the word trigger, but I guess the reaction to those sounds. And I would say now it's extended, though, to a very wide spectrum of reactions, I would say, to many different sounds. But interestingly enough, back in 2012, that was when I first heard of the term misophonia. So I was already at the end of my high school years, you know, going into uni, and like my bachelor's, I mean. And I remember Googling, "I hate sounds and I hate certain movements." Yeah, it's like, you know, you're like this 15-year-old, you're like, "I hate everyone, I hate sounds,
right.
I want silence," you know. And the term misophonia came up, and this was literally like, you know, a decade ago. And I think it was like WebMD, you know, these like websites where they list like, I don't remember which one it was. I definitely think it was one of those. And it just said like, you know, misophonia is not like an official condition, but it's characterized by like people who have an aversion to sounds. I'm like, oh yeah, that's me. That's it. You know, I have misophonia. And I kind of just left it there for another 10 years and never really thought about it again. Up until like recently, somehow weirdly the sounds have been becoming way more severe than ever. I don't know if it's because we forget how it was in the past, because we always feel things that are currently happening to us are way more intense, and we tend to forget, you know, how painful things can be. You know, think of like when you break, I don't know, you scratch your arm, you'll forget the pain in a week, right? But if it's happening right now, that's when it's most intense. So I don't know if it's becoming more intense or it's just the current experience is more intense. But either way, it's again that the whole misophonia conversation has kind of opened up to me, because to be very honest, I've been very dismissive of my own condition, I would say. I don't know if you had the same thing.
Yeah, you know, a lot of people, right. I had a similar thing where I found out about it first in 2007 or so.
Oh, wow.
And obviously, you know, I experienced it obviously at home growing up. But then it wasn't as big, it didn't seem as big of a deal like in college and at the beginning of my career, but then it was enough that seeing an article about it in 2007, I knew what it was immediately. Yeah. But it is true that then maybe it was only a couple of years went by when it kind of like a bit on the back burner, when I went into an open office environment and heard some of the stuff there, then it was like, okay, this is a real thing. And it's not going anywhere. And so it does kind of ebb and flow, and other people have said similar things. I'm curious, were you dismissive of your own misophonia because you just didn't think it was serious, or I don't know, you had that feedback from people who told about it?
No, it wasn't the feedback. It was definitely just me being dismissive to my own condition.
Yeah.
I think I've felt like I did not want it to define me. Mm-hmm. Even by talking to you, if I'm honest, I was very shy and hesitant because I thought, is this really, the first thing I want to put out there into this world? Because, and I guess at least in my mind, each one of us are much more than our misophonia, right? It's something we live with, but it's not the entirety of us. And so for that reason, there was this hesitation, shame, or even guilt that came with it, because mm-hmm. I didn't want it to solely be remembered as my identity. Mm-hmm. But on the other hand, and much, thanks to your podcast as well, I see that now there probably is nothing to be ashamed of, and the more open we are about it, the more people can be aware of it too. So hiding it is actually probably making it worse in the longer term, right? Because it's not actually helping those of us who suffer with it to make it better in the long run. Yeah, so I feel it came a lot with like an identity issue, that I don't want this to be an identity of me, because my personality is generally very, kind and social. And when we tend to get triggered, we can become a little bit aggro, even if it's like an internal, like a twitch, it kind of goes against like my natural nature of being friendly and sweet or whatever it may be. So I think that's where it kind of came through, and I would just try to dismiss it almost and be like, forget this, just try to mask or hide it as best you can.
Right, because the thing that's funny, it easily gets simplified, and we simplified it to ourselves that it's just an aggro kind of thing, so we don't want to be perceived as aggro. That makes sense. We know why we kind of like try to suppress it.
Right.
But, and like you said, even what I've learned from the podcast is it's so much, it's part of everyone's, everyone who has misophonia is a very complex person. And so it definitely, even if you wanted to try to, even if somebody wanted to define you as misophonic, that's it's so not the case as soon as you get to know somebody. And it's opened me up to these other things like HSP, the nervous system, and different ways to kind of like, help it. I originally, when I started the podcast, I thought it was just probably some biological brain thing, quote unquote. But I've learned a lot more, and so I think it helps. What we're sharing is going to help us deal with misophonia and many other things too. But that doesn't dismiss the fact that misophonia is a real thing, because as we know, we have some pretty intense reactions.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. You nailed it on the head. And we now know through a lot of, brain studies, brain scans and things like that, there are a lot of areas of our brain that are highlighted during, when we hear or when we see even certain triggers. For example, the amygdala, as I'm sure you already know, the ventromedial prefrontal cortex, all of these, the auditory, cortex, hippocampus, all these areas in the brain. And as you said yourself, it's not just about brain reaction. There's a lot of childhood experiences that come through it, because most of, our trigger points come from there, and it could be a lot to do with our relationship conditioning. So as you said, it's very complex, and for each person it probably diversifies a little bit. So kind of boiling it down to sounds make me angry, it's definitely very reductionist kind of a way of thinking. But you're right, at the end of it all, we do get, you know, heightened heart rate and what they call galvanic skin response when we hear those sounds. So there are definitely those like physical triggers as well, which again may go against our certain nature of like, or our personality traits when we're not being, when our nervous system is, you know, calm.
Yeah, I want to come back to what you just said about the different parts of the brain, because I think there is a, I want to come back to a little bit to the kind of that I don't know if it's a debate, but the kind of the limbic versus prefrontal kind of, I feel like there's kind of like some unspoken kind of debate or something. Is this a reptilian thing, or is this something we can tackle purely from the on a, you know, more cognitive prefrontal ways, or if it's a combination? Sure. But I do want to, you know, you mentioned childhood. I'm just curious. Growing up, it sounds like your grandfather and your uncle were triggers. What about the like your immediate family life, your nuclear family? Was there, were you being triggered by them? How were they? How did they? Did they notice your reactions?
Yeah. Honestly, I think my parents were generally very understanding. Especially now, they try to be understanding to what was happening to me, because even as a kid, I don't know if this is a good thing or not, but I never was able to like hold feelings inside. So if I would get triggered, like I would probably say something, again, not to like my uncles or whoever, but if it was my mom or my dad or my sister, I would definitely like be very vocal about it. Like, stop, don't do that. Like, this is, you know, this is really hurting my ears. And they would be quite understanding about it, and they wouldn't like push probe too much about it, which I think was nice. But in, you know, when I'm traveling to Azerbaijan, we're always with, like, you're never alone. So basically, if you ever, I'm sure you know this, like how extended families are, there's constantly gatherings. And, you know, I would travel to Azerbaijan the summer for 3 months. So there's always someone around, you know, like my grandma, my cousins, my uncles, and there's constantly like trigger sounds. So it's moments like that where I would have to like run away or hide or go to the bathroom or like pretend like, you know, sometimes I would even speak over them like really loudly to try to like, yeah, you know, I'm like, wait, what? And they're like, why is she screaming? Yeah. We're like right opposite each other. So just kind of trying to find little ways to cope with it. But my mom, I think she actually has misophonia herself. Because when my uncle would drink soup, she would also tell him to stop that. So, but I don't think it's as extreme as mine, but she definitely does get, triggered a little bit too. My sister, on the other hand, she has mixed feelings about my misophonia, and good thing she doesn't listen to podcasts ever. So she'll definitely not hear this and like, you know, but I think she finds it extremely annoying, especially when we're on holiday together, and this is more recent rather than childhood. But I think for her, it kind of feels like, just deal with it. You know, why are you being so difficult? And it's, again, that's where that conflict in her, my poor sister, she's going to be like, what the hell? But anyway, this is where like the inner conflict again comes in, because you really, really want to be chill, right? But then when you hear the sound, you just say like, oh, you know, can we move to another table? Like, I can't sit in front next to these people, because they keep smacking their lips or they keep blowing their nose, and it's, I can't handle it. Like, I will not be able to eat here. Right. So then she's like, oh, you know, you're making a big deal out of nothing. Like, why is it so hard to like do day to day, like normal things with you, you know? So in those instances, it can be quite difficult, and you feel guilty, you know, you feel bad, because you're like, oh, I'm ruining this person's day with my behaviors. So in moments like that, it can be very tricky. But again, but luckily for me, I'm blessed that my parents were always very understanding about it. And they would try to not trigger me in that sense. Yeah.
What was the kind of the culture around talking about mental health in Dubai and Azerbaijan? I'm assuming it was totally open and everyone loved to talk about it.
I sensed it. Oh my god, yeah. It's like you know,
I mean, I also come from an Asian, I should say, I've come from a, background as well. So it's, I can kind of like riff around that part of the world, I hope, without offending too
totally,
many people.
Not at all. Totally, you can. And it's so funny because, you know, when people, when you say like, oh, I'm feeling like, I think I'm like properly depressed, and they're like, you know, just like have soup and you'll feel better. You're like, oh, great advice, mom, thanks, you know. So
yeah,
but in Azerbaijan,
that's like a Christina was on, there's somebody named Christina was on earlier,
yeah,
and her mom told her to just write it down on a piece of paper and then throw it out.
I love it. So superstition. Yeah, my grandma would probably like start telling me, oh, you have a bad eye, let's do a little, you know, let's put some salt around you and chant something, right, and then throw it in the fire, and you're like, wait, what? But yeah, bless her soul. It's interesting because so Azerbaijan used to be a part of the Soviet Union, right?
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. in Russia, or, you know, post-Soviet countries, which Azerbaijan was a part of, mental health, or in more of a sense, I would say psychiatric conditions, were very well studied, right? But they would see it as, it would be very extreme, you know? So if you're clinically depressed, you need, you know, psychiatric care. If you have a hallucination, you need to be locked up and you're mad, you know? The whole madness kind of narrative was very, very strong. So even most of my family are doctors, by the way, so they're quite open with these conversations. And my mom studied neurology as well. You know, she finished med school and she studied psychiatry. So she was quite, you know, my family is quite open within these conversations, but they view it in a very different way, you know? So they would view it in a sense like, yes, schizophrenia, you know, someone who has hallucinations equals mental or mad, you know? Whereas I would argue with her now and say, well, that's not entirely the case, because not everyone who's, you know, schizophrenic is a serial killer, which is like, you know, sometimes the old narrative. So I would say there's a lot of that old stigma, definitely. But it's changing, I'm sure, you know, it's definitely changing. Everyone has a therapist now, which is interesting. And Dubai,
oh, even so, over there, like Dubai and Azerbaijan.
So in Azerbaijan, you would always go see your physician if you have anything, you know? So even when I had had anxiety and like serious panic attacks, a neurologist would see me, not a psychiatrist, you know? The neurologist would give you like Xanax or whatever, which I never took because I hated it. But the point is that, there would be less of like psychiatry unless you actually need inpatient care. At least this is my knowledge. Don't quote me on this because I could be absolutely wrong. I've never lived there. But in the UAE, at least, mental health it's really at the forefront right now. It's actually quite amazing. There are so many apps as well. There's one called Fitzy Health, which is an online app that was created that is, you know, at reach for anyone. It's based in the UAE, but they do it globally, obviously, because they're online. There's a huge wellness center here called Lighthouse Arabia, and they do so much for mental health support, people, you know, suicide prevention, people who have grief, you know, who've lost someone. They do like, you know, different people who have been clinically depressed, addiction support. They have a lot of services. So the narrative here is definitely changing. However, there are still many communities and groups that would not talk about their mental health, especially men, which I think is, again, very prominent in Asia in general, and like in our parts of the region, because, you know, men don't cry and men don't share their feelings. So that is still out there, I think, just like the rest of the world. But it's definitely shifting a lot. There's a lot of awareness for it, for sure.
Yeah, that's interesting. That's great to hear. I was curious if those wellness centers were they, you know, kind of secular in nature, or they didn't have any like, you know, religious kind of connotations or anything. Because, you know, growing up as a male Muslim, I definitely get the whole, don't think about that. Just read this book, this old book.
Yeah.
And that'll solve your problems.
Have you ever like approached your parents with any, you know, whenever you felt down or if you ever felt that you were going through some, like a hard time?
I don't think so. No. Yeah. I mean, it just kind of, it's usually, yeah. I mean, usually I would assume the answer is usually, well, you know, here, just pray two rakas. And
I love that. I love that. Know, just make a dua, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So, yeah, definitely would not be right. Unless, like you said, like, unless there was evidence of like some madness. So, you know, there's that. It's mental health is considered like you're insane. And you're,
yeah, exactly, right? They're like, lock her up. I'm like, exactly. Hey, he just has anxiety. Calm down.
Right. Those are for anxiety, and then mental institutions are for like, you know, anything else mentally, you know, mentally related. So
I'm kind of glad misophonia was never discovered. Imagine they just locked us all up. They're like, they can't function properly to sounds. We need to put them all in a room.
I bet there would just be a lot of exposure therapy. I can't imagine
other
kind of nuanced way of dealing with it. They would just probably force it out of you or something. Try to.
Yeah. Excuse my language. You've spoken to so many people. Has anyone done exposure therapy? Because to me, really, I think that's like a nightmare of an approach. So I'm very curious.
Yeah, I was talking to success. It's definitely it's never come up. And there's somebody a local here who's kind of worked at clinics that are more OCD based. And I guess because you know more maybe that because I guess OCD one of the therapies is actually exposure to you know. And so I heard that when parents then bring their kids to these clinics, the clinic just assumes that it's some kind of form of OCD, and they just, that's what they do. They try to just expose the kid, and it's just horrible. I've heard about that, but I've never heard it go well.
Yeah, me neither. Exposure therapy for OCD, that definitely works. So I'm also a germaphobe. Of course, we have a million things that's right with us. I actually did cognitive behavioral therapy and a form of like exposure therapy for that. And it definitely was very helpful. But for misophonia, it just can't work because I don't know how to explain it. For germophobia, it worked because your fear is the actual germs, right? Your fear is getting sick, at least for me. So what was the fear behind the germophobia? The fear is that if I touch something and I don't wash my hands, I will get sick, right? And the more you, let's say, touch something and then don't wash your hands and you don't get sick, then that exposure, eventually, after a long term, you tend to, you know, your nervous system tends to not associate it anymore with danger, right? That's how I see it, and that's how it worked for me. Whereas if it's misophonia, the fear itself is the sound. So exposing it to more sound isn't going to make it go away. I don't know if this logic makes any sense, but that's how I see it. But I've tried it and it hasn't helped.
You tried it for sound?
And not therapeutically, like not with an actual therapist.
Right.
Right, just myself. I'm like, I'm going to expose myself and not put, you know, noise canceling headphones and see what happens in 5 minutes.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, kind of thinking kind of openly and kind of the devil's advocate. I mean, you know, I've thought about if misophonia is a response to your nervous system assigning danger to the sound based on maybe could be some traumatic thing, could be some epigenetic thing from the past. I don't know, but it's not completely illogical to think that. Maybe listening to that sound and then not being attacked can kind of reassure your nervous system that the sound is not going to hurt you, or the thing that's causing the sound is not going to hurt you. So I can see how there could be some logic there, but it just never works in reality.
Yeah, you're so right. When you think of it in that way, it can. But even from what I've read, study-wise, there hasn't been much, you know, progress for exposure therapy and misophonia. So I'm just wondering, you know, why that is. And I don't know if it's that we're too fearful of it, and there's too mm-hmm. much of an impact on us that it's impossible. But interestingly, there have been recent studies. I think there was a study published in 2020, like literally last year, on what is that called? Give me a moment. Oh, yeah. Neurostimulation, like stimulating mm-hmm. certain areas of the brain, like either inhibiting them or excitatoring them, and seeing how that works for misophonia, which, again, is something that they do for patients with OCD. So, you know, that's interesting.
Yeah. But again, was there any outcome from that was interesting?
I think the study itself the paper was kind of more discussing what neurostimulation is and how it would work and how it currently works on patients with like OCD. But I don't think there's enough studies done yet on misophonia patients because, mainly because there's so many areas of the brain that could be impacted and many ways that could be approached. And also, neurostimulation does come with side effects, right? So things like seizures are possible. Of course, like the percentages, like, I don't know, maybe like 40-50%. But there's a lot of like side effects, I would say. So it's something that needs to be taken into consideration, and you can't just take a bunch of people and, you know, do what's it called, like transcranial magnetic
TMR
like,
yeah. Yeah, TMI is something else. Interesting. Okay, I guess they're not, like, as we know there's a lot of study that needs to happen. Sounds like this paper was kind of more pointing to a potential direction for more research.
Yeah, exactly.
Trying to combine these, yeah. Interesting. Okay. Yeah, so you mentioned, germaphobe. I think you mentioned earlier, kind of alluding to, like, movement. So I'm assuming, like, misokinesia, the kind of visual triggers is a big deal for you as well, maybe?
Yeah, it is, unfortunately. It's definitely a trigger, too. Even just sometimes seeing people... And I actually read this in your book with, you know, Dr. Jane Gregory, that they mentioned, A, it's the person sometimes that can be triggering for you, and then B, certain movements and certain tonalities. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting that two people could make the same movement, but one person may be a little bit more triggering than the other. And that's kind of mind-blowing to me. Why? But generally, if someone is, I don't know how to explain, like making a chewing movement without even hearing the sound, I would potentially get annoyed. It's strange. Even if someone comes too close and like they don't actually scrape off me, but I feel like they would, like even that sensory movement would piss me off. So
yeah.
I don't know if that's directly related to misophonia, but it has all to do with like sounds and, you know, movement being too close. Like, I don't know if this is also like a boundary thing, you know, feeling like you're being violated almost.
Oh, that's an interesting idea. Yeah, because I've mentioned before, I feel like in the future the name might change, but it won't be just a sound thing. I feel like there is more going on. But that's interesting, what you said about boundaries, and almost a sense of being, some kind of violation happening. Because all these things, that's kind of what this comment. I do, especially with the closeness and the touching kind of thing, sometimes. But I'm wondering if, like, even the, I'm trying to frame the sound and visual stuff as kind of a bound. I'm going to have to ponder that because, it's something that just seems like the sound is really, that's all you can focus on. and it seems like it's right close to you. And it seems like, you know, I always think, I think often when I'm being triggered, it's like, you know, everything's fine. It's just one thing that if I can make that go away, everything's fine. It's like it intruded on my current environment. It's almost, you know, in some ways, it's kind of like a boundary violation.
Yeah, exactly. No, I feel that exact same way. And you tend to get angry at that person, and you know, you feel like they're doing it on purpose. Although that person's probably just living his best life, has no idea, scraping chairs, you know, chewing loudly.
They knew you were there and they came to.
Yeah. They were waiting for us, you know. This was all a part of their plan.
No, you're right. That's an interesting way. Do you consider, have you heard the term HSP? I'm sure you have. HSP, highly sensitive person. Is that something you identify with?
That's so funny because a few weeks ago, my friend, she purchases the book. I forgot the author's name. I think her name is Elaine something.
Some old school name, yeah.
Yeah. I definitely need to find it now. But anyway, so she purchases this book and she's like, oh my gosh, I'm reading the absolutely most amazing book. It's called The Highly Sensitive Person. You have to take this test online because I think we're both it, you know? So, and I've heard this term a few years back. Me and my best friend actually talked about it when we were kind of talking about, we're both like, you know, I don't want to use the word special, but you know, we have some quirks here and there. So she sent this to me a few years back saying like, by the way, it could be that we're, you know, extremely, we're HSPs or whatever. And then again, like, you know, you read something and then you're like, yeah, you move on and forget it. And then 2 weeks ago, another friend of mine again sent it. And I was like, holy shit, like this term, you know, I've seen it a few years back. And so I reread it again and I'm like, this makes, you know, you really identify it. And Adil, I feel like I actually used to do a podcast where you talk about it with, you know, one of the, I don't know if you call it interviews, attendees. How do I call it? Your guests, I guess I would say. Yeah. So, you really identify with a HSP, don't you?
And yeah.
Generally people with misophonia.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely. And do you think, is HSP just is it taken seriously at all in like the, I don't know, in the psychology community, or is it just kind of like a, kind of a more pop culture kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't know enough, so I can't lie and say, but one thing I will say though, I think this is a personal opinion and I hope I don't insult anyone.
That's what we're all here for. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, it's very similar to when we discovered like attachment styles, right? I'm sure you've heard of this, that some people are secure attachment, some people are anxious avoidant, some people are ambivalent attached. And then based on these attachment styles, this is how and why we behave in relationships. And this is how, you know, we have formed relationships with our primary caregivers, which could be, you know, either our parents or whoever would, you know, raised us. So when we think of concepts and constructs, we have to take them, in my opinion, with a pinch of salt, with a grain of salt, right? Because these are concepts or constructs that help us identify and understand and learn about ourselves, but they're not like set in stone, you know? It's not the same as, let's say, knowing how much, you know, insulin you have in your body, or, you know, whether, you know, the beat of your heart rate, etc., if that makes sense. When you look at it in PubMed or like in any big, you know, journals, there's not much on this topic. So as you said, I think it's more, I don't know if it's pop culture or not, but it's like a concept or construct. I think Elaine Aron is her name or something.
Yes.
That, right. You know, she coined the term, but that's not to say that it's not real. You know, it's not to say that it's this concept or, you know, this form of being doesn't exist. It absolutely does, because many people identify with it, you know? And I think it's extremely helpful to identify with it, because again, you understand yourself, you understand why you react to certain things, and it also helps other people understand you. So I think they're highly useful, but I don't like, as you can tell, identifying as one thing, like I'm, mm-hmm. you know, I have misophonia, I'm a highly sensitive person, I have germophobia, because then it limits you to much more of what you are, if that makes sense. But yeah, again, I mean, that's my personal opinion. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's one of the critiques of things like the DSM is like, yeah, sure, it helps you get some kind of, it gets you in the door to maybe a doctor, but then it's like, sure, there's a lot of studies behind, you know, how these names are, you know, names of conditions are formed, but are also kind of like, to a lay person, it can kind of be very black and white, where it's much more complex. There's a lot of, you know, from even with misophonia, most of us have other things that kind of overlap. And so, I don't know, I feel like some of these boxes can kind of like get in the way of figuring out, you know, what's actually going on. And something at HSP is very encompassing, at least. It's this kind of one appeal of it. It's not a disorder or condition per se, but it, exactly. it's kind of like a continuum. But it definitely feels like a lot of us identify with it a lot more than others. I feel like I'm kind of borderline. I wouldn't say I'm like completely over into HSP, but yeah, I wanted to talk about one thing. So you mentioned attachment theory, I think. Yes. Are you familiar with like, Gabor Maté? And I think he talks about like attachment and authenticity. That's something I talk about that a lot in therapy as well. And I feel like that is, obviously he thinks that it's kind of the root of many of our anxieties and conditions. And I've thought about that in terms of, I don't know if he knows about misophonia at all, but I've thought about maybe this in terms of misophonia. And other things like, we go in many different directions, but have you thought about that? I don't know. Or can you maybe, speculate on misophonia and, kind of attachment authenticity issues?
Yeah. That's a really interesting one. Attachment styles is an interesting one too, because according to this theory, we all have kind of a main attachment style, and that is based on the way, again, we had a relationship with our primary caregivers. And it's funny what you're saying, because on the one hand, if I speculate from, you know, like anecdotally, so from my own personal experience, not, you know, I'm not scientifically or anything, but although my, you know, parents were, as I said, extremely supportive, and my mom was, you know, always like there for me, etc. You know, post-Soviet Russian moms, they're very cold, you know. I don't know if you know, if anyone from like the Soviets will tell, we always laugh, like people from, you know, Eurasia, Eastern Europe were like, yeah, our parents never said they loved us, because like it's just not a thing there, you know. So so there's a bit of that, and there's a bit of, funnily enough, you're bringing back a lot of memories. When we were young, me and my sister, we were both never allowed to be loud in public. Always, always shushed. Like, although my personality by default is, you know, very loud and, you know, I'm comfortable being social. But when we were young, like 7, 8, 9, up to 13, we were always told, like, when you're in public, don't speak, like, don't, you know, kind of give out your own opinion, don't scream, if
don't
we ever like scream, don't rock the boat, right? Like, don't, you know, don't be loud, and, you know, be respectful, don't ever show discomfort. So I think sometimes it always makes me wonder, I don't know if I've just read too many psychology books at this point, but when I look at kids screaming, I'm like, do they piss me off because I was not allowed to scream as a child, you know? So now it's my inner child screaming, like, you can't make that noise. Like, how dare you? Because I wasn't allowed to make that noise, right? So, again, it comes to, like, avoidant attachment styles, I guess. But, I mean, I don't know how much that is all related. At this point, I'm literally just talking shit. But it is interesting that I wasn't allowed to make a lot of sounds. So I was always very conscious of sounds in general, whether it's eating, whether it's talking, you know, whether it's screaming and being like, you know, loud or whatever. So I don't know how much that triples through. But then again, my sister didn't get impacted by that. So there's so many factors, right?
Yeah, no, I was going to say that. Like, what you just said, I had a similar kind of background where, yeah, don't rock the boat. Don't, really? You know, don't be late for places. Don't talk. Yeah, don't be too loud. Don't show discomfort. Don't cause discomfort. And so,
God, don't be late to places. Did you say yep. that? Mm-hmm. Oh, my mm-hmm. God. That was a huge one for me.
Oh, that's even to this day, if anyone in my family seems like they might be late for something or might be holding us up from getting somewhere on time, I get really anxious.
Wait, I'm the same. I'm not even mm-hmm. kidding. Time is the one thing that freaks mm-hmm. the hell out of me. Shit, mm-hmm. that's crazy. Mm-hmm. Huh.
And yeah, that's a direct line to childhood for me.
Yeah, yeah, no doubt. Like, so, dad leaving you on the street if you don't come by 3:01, you know? Right, no, right. I'm kidding, but kind of.
So, I mean, that gets in. Yeah, so I'm always very curious about it. Kind of like, obviously, I lean a lot towards there's got to be stuff in childhood that have kind of affected this. But then, yeah, as you were saying that, I was like, yeah, your sister, obviously, kind of went the other way or just didn't affect her. You know, obviously there's other factors. Is it something we're not born to have, but is there something that we're more, some of us are more predisposed either epigenetically or otherwise to kind of have that switch flip for us? That's kind of my next question, which is going to be unanswered for a while. But
definitely going to be unanswered for a while, but it will, I don't think it'll ever be fully answered, because as you mm-hmm. said, we are so complex, and as the field of epigenetics is growing, we know everything is an interaction and a correlation between our genes and our environment. And by the way, what's even more interesting is even though you and your sister or your sibling, whoever, brother, sister, are grown in the same household, your relationship with your parents or your primary caregivers will still be different, you know? My sister was treated very differently. I was... weirdly, ironically, the spoiled one, of always the younger one is always the more spoiled one, you know? So mm-hmm. My sister, I think I would say, had more of a detachment from my family than I did, for example, from my parents than I did. Not to say that she's not close to them, but just generally speaking. So even if we were in the same household and had the same environment, the environment would differ for us because A, our personalities right off the boat are completely different. So that's in itself. And then even our relationships with our environment and the way we interact with it is different too. So then that comes into play. And of course, our genes and things like that. So it's always going to be different, you know? So it makes sense. My sister probably has a lot of other things that I don't, and vice versa. Probably the same thing in your household and others too.
Oh, yeah. And since you said you're around family a lot, I'm curious, even whether in your nuclear family or other family members that you were close to, did you ever, was there anyone who's like often kind of dysregulated? Like, did you see a lot of like dysregulated behaviors, like tempers and things like that growing up?
Not dysregulated, mm-hmm. But I'm not very comfortable sharing this. I don't know if you'd want to maybe cut it out or maybe not. Yeah. But, you know, my dad, when we were very young, he got into a really bad accident. Mm-hmm. They used to tell us it was an accident. Basically, he was in Russia and him and his friends got into a huge fight and someone broke a bottle on his head. Mm-hmm. And so he lost half his brain and most of the areas of his brain that were impacted were some of his areas that are in charge of social cues, but mm-hmm. also other areas kind of on the temporal medial lobe area. But anyway, so the point is my dad was kind of not well for a very big chunk of our childhood, and I think mm-hmm. I've suppressed that a lot. Mm-hmm. Which probably has impacted also because I grew up being super, super, super close to my dad as from a very young age. We were besties. Mm-hmm. And then until I hit teenage years, I was still very young. I think I was not even teenager yet, 11, maybe 10 or 11. You know, my dad was in hospital for a year under, you know, supervision. And then when he did come out, he was a complete different person. So he had very dysregulated behaviors, which again, I probably suppressed for a long time, like touch wood, thank God he's all good now. But I think that definitely may have played a role, you know, but I just never looked into it because, you know, as human beings, we tend to shove things deep down and not look back.
No, that sounds terrible. I'm glad he's feeling better.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm just curious because a lot of us kind of, I know I've probably mimicked some of my behaviors based on, like, you know, volatility in
really?
Other people's behaviors growing up.
Do you mind me asking, like, for example, an example?
Oh, well, yeah. I mean, I wrote a letter to my child self that's at the end of one of the chapters of the book, I think. And it's actually, I kind of wrote it in real time as I realized that, you know, I would see, you know, I would, something would be misplaced in the house. And then it would kind of like, it would go from Jekyll and Hyde situation. Where, you know, I'd be playing or doing whatever, and then suddenly everyone had to drop everything and, like, look for this thing and then be eviscerated for not finding it or having it misplaced or something. And so there was a lot of, then, you know, trying to listen to what is everybody's moods on different floors of the house from, like, two floors away. And then somebody came on the podcast recently and recounted something similar and said she would, you know, kind of glue her ears to the heating vents to kind of hear what was being, I guess in her case, it was like parents fighting, you know?
Yeah.
And so, the letter to myself also, I think, mentioned that, you know, the only thing that would stop this would be, usually the only thing that would stop this kind of like tense situation would be then a quiet dinner time. And I would be dysregulated. Well, I would be, my nervous system would be kind of like completely shot, and then I have to go sit down and listen to people eat. And so you can only imagine potentially, you know, what your body's feeling and kind of sensing. And so that's when I'm still kind of listening for different moods, right? But I'm also hearing all the chewing. And so I don't know, it's a potential connection, but it's interesting to think about. So I was kind of ask people who've come on and have had alcoholic parents or other kind of things, like, you know.
Yeah.
And it does come up a lot.
I want to hug baby Adil. Give him comfort, because I just know how horrible that is.
Oh, thank you. It's interesting to see kind of these commonalities from people, and I think everyone's kind of like making these connections and hopefully making amends, and at least we're able to kind of like move on from this, and part of it is it is kind of soothing that child, that inner child that you've mentioned a couple times.
You know, your book is actually, I feel, going to be very life-changing. So I was so excited when I got it. I read the first chapter, I'm like, this is awesome. I went to, I think it was chapter 2, and I was like, I'm scared that I'm going to get triggered reading this book. And so I skipped to, like, I think chapter 4. I've been jumping from chapters. I really need to start reading.
That's kind of the point.
That's what I love about it.
The instructions actually say, please jump around and put it down, come back. So,
Yes, I love that. And I think it was in one of the chapters, like, if you're not ready to, like, yet explore this in deep, just, like, jump to chapter 7, you know? So I've kind of been doing that. And just, like, reading, you know, your stories and also just other people, like, what you're writing makes you think about your own experiences as well. That's why I think it's going to be so life-changing. I did have, like, a little aha moment. Again, it's a bit of a personal thing, so as you can tell, I'm a little reserved in sharing, apologies for that. But it was definitely a very, you know, big moment for me to realize, oh shit, like, this is connected, you know? And I think, like, in moments like that, it almost feels like you feel better, you know? I don't know how to explain it. Even though it's not like, oh, my misophonia is gone now, but you kind of feel like you understand yourself a bit better, and that feels empowering, right?
Right.
So yeah, I'm excited to read it like a normal person and not like keep jumping and jumping. it's an awesome book, and I definitely just recommend anyone with miso who has it to get it, because yeah, it's important to look within. And I think I'm glad that we are moving towards this kind of era, I would say, where people are very open to self-exploration, looking into, you know, their childhood, family behaviors and patterns, because these are the things that we could actually change. So, yeah, I think that's very cool. I did go off topic here a bit, but
no, that's great. I was gonna say, I actually have a kind of a hard stop in a few minutes for a work meeting, but yeah. I was gonna ask, I mean, if you have any final words, but that was actually a great, I don't know, that was kind of like a great way to sum things up. But do you have any kind of like anything else you kind of want to share with the audience? Not to put you on the spot, but
no, not at all.
You've done a great job already. It's been great.
Oh no, not at all. Thank you. You're very kind. I think you can cut this part out if you don't think it's relevant, but
sure.
I think one thing that has helped me is just finding something that helps you regulate your system. Mm-hmm. So for me, that's dancing. In particular, it's something called conscious dancing. And if you know, you've never heard of it, I highly recommend.
There is an episode on your podcast about it. So I'll try to put a link to it. Yeah.
No, that's very kind. But because it basically, for me, it combines the healing sounds of music, which music is something I absolutely love, and also letting go of tension that's held in your body. So conscious dancing is you move a lot. So it kind of allows you to enter this void if you enjoy, you know, deep house, or if you enjoy listening to music. And it's very immersive, that allows your mind and your body to kind of flow together rather than against each other. Because I feel, you know, in our day-to-day we have a lot of resistance and there's sometimes a disconnect. So during dancing, I feel there's that harmony when your, you know, mind and body are finally like, let's integrate, and it's peaceful to my ears. It's so regulating for my nervous system. So I think it's all about, when trying to find things to calm you, find things that is regulating for you. And I think that kind of helps me. If I go through a session of conscious dancing, weirdly enough, for the next day or so, somehow my misophonia triggers won't be as intense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, that's great. Yeah, mind-body integration, being, I think, more aware. I think being more aware of your senses, like, this is a whole other topic, but I feel like some books I've read from, ironically, from an architecture store that I've been to.
Wow.
It was pointed out to me in this book. I think it's called The Eyes of the, I don't know, I forget what it's called. It's actually right behind me, but the book's making an argument that our society now is so focused on visuals and all of our stimulation is so processed that we've kind of become disconnected with our senses. And maybe, and then I got started thinking, maybe is that somehow related to our, you know, dysregulation with our senses, and potentially misophonia as being an outcome of that. So like I said, whole other topic, maybe it's more philosophical, but I think maybe you'd be the right person to kind of like have another discussion about that. But I want to take a look at conscious dancing again, because I think that's amazing to hear that if that kind of calms you down for another day.
Yeah, it's definitely not for everyone, but I think there is something out there for everyone. So that's always a good thing.
Yeah. Cool. Well, Ciara, this has been great. It flew by. Hopefully you felt good talking. But I think we got a lot of great information. This is fascinating to get to know you better. And thanks for coming on.
Thank you so much, Ado. You're a wonderful host. And yeah, you make all your guests feel so comfortable. So I really appreciate it.
Thank you again, Ciara. Great to have you on the other side of the mic, and I look forward to many more episodes of your podcast. If you liked this episode, don't forget to leave a quick review or just hit the 5 stars wherever you listen to this show. You can hit me up by email at hello@misophoniapodcast.com or go to the website, misophoniapodcast.com. It's even easier just to send a message on Instagram at Misophonia Podcast, follow there, or Facebook at Misophonia Podcast. On Twitter, X, it's Misophonia Show. Support the show by visiting the Patreon at patreon.com/misophoniapodcast. Music, as always, is by Moby. And until next week, wishing you peace.